Hello and welcome to the Magic Musicals and Theatre Podcast. I'm Alice Arnold, and this week my special guests are Dan Gillespie-Sells, the lead singer of The Feeling, and the comedy and drama writer Tom McRae. Welcome to the Magic Musicals and Theatre Podcast. With me in the studio today, we have Tom McRae, who is a writer, and Dan Gillespie-Sells from The Feeling, who is now also a writer, getting awards for writing. But before we start, as we always start our Magic Musicals and Theatre Podcasts, we start with cake.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. We start with cake from these Gemma's cupcakes. I don't know, the shop's just around the corner, which is handy. And there's a different ones. You get to have two, and Sarah and I, my producer, we eat the ones you don't want.
Oh, wow.
So there are six.
There's
three of each. They're mini.
How gorgeous.
They are mini.
I was going to say, six is quite a lot.
But look at the artistry in that. There's a jammy
like bacon
dodger.
For life again.
It is. Only I'm not revealing the winner. That the there's jammy dodger ones and cookie dough ones.
Jammy dodgers.
So
makes me think of my nan, jammy dodgers.
Well, then you should have one of those, I think.
I think I might have to go for a jammy dodger.
Don't you think? Yeah. I think the jammy dodgers just looked so incredible.
Look at that.
Don't you think?
Thank you very much.
Well,
they're
you
really
can
gorgeous.
Have one of each because there are six. So
well, we've got
that's the
press
point.
Mic tuxes to fit into. So I might just.
Who's going to make me look greedy if I have two?
You must have another.
No, no, I don't want to take more.
Because Sarah and I will just pick up the crumbs from the rest of the party.
I'm married in 3 weeks, so I guess I should be thinking about all sorts of tuxes.
Are you?
But I'm going to have my...
Are you hiring the suit?
No, it's all very informal. I've got a fine selection of suits to
draw
on.
Oh. Yeah.
Get him.
Good, yeah, get you.
That'll be my press night suit again, I think.
Well, same thing, press night and marriage. We're not here, actually, to talk about cakes or suits particularly. We are here to talk about, well, what everybody's talking about, because the title of the show we're talking about, everybody's talking about Jamie.
When we started writing it, we just had the working title of Jamie. And I always said, I think the title will end up being the title of one of the songs. And so everybody's talking about Jamie's the song that opens Act Two, and it just seemed like such a great title because it's kind of like a headline that's written already.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's the headline. Everybody's talking about Jamie has cropped up quite a few times as we hoped it would.
And it's very catchy. I don't think anyone will forget that. And it is a true story, this new show, which is a story about... Will you tell me the story, the true story?
The story is of a 16-year-old boy at his school. Has the dream of growing up and becoming a drag queen, a professional drag queen. Doesn't really know how to start going about it, but also wants to announce his dream and announce his thing by turning up at the school disco, or the school prom, as they call them nowadays, in a dress. And it's a true story. It's inspired by a documentary that we saw that many years ago. Jonathan Butterwell, our director, saw a documentry about 5 years ago now, was it?
I think it was, because Jamie
2011,
was... Jamie
I
Campbell,
think. So
in
6 years,
In our show, it's Jamie New and Margaret New as his mum, because we distance ourselves to an extent from the reality of their story, so we're not just telling their story, it is our story inspired by their story.
Mm-hmm.
But Jamie Campbell was 16 when the documentary was made, and he's now 22, so it must have come out when he was about 17, so yeah.
That's right, yeah. So that was a few years ago now, and then what happened was, Jonathan Buttle saw the documentary and thought, this is a great idea for a show, and I think it could be a really wonderful musical, and was in discussions with Daniel Evans at the Crucible Theatre. And Daniel loved the idea as well. And then he had to set about finding the writers. And that's the next stage of the story, is when me and Tom were put in touch with Jonathan.
But quite by chance, Dan and I had met quite a few years before, actually on a rally. And we kind of hit it off, and I was a huge fan of Dan's music. And I had a sitcom on TV at the time that Dan likes, so we kind of had a professional love-in as well. And Dan kept saying, we should write a musical. And so we started about writing some songs, but we didn't have a clue what we were doing. And then we bumped into Michael Ball at the theatre. Literally, we didn't know him. We just, there he was, and he was Michael Ball. And so we said hello, and we kind of introduced ourselves. And Michael, God bless him, took an interest in us. He took us under his wing, gave us some advice, and ultimately put us in touch with Jonathan Butterell. And we had absolutely no idea that Johnny Butterell was looking for writers, was struggling to find writers. And then he heard about these two guys who just started writing musicals and thought we could be the ones. And it all fell into place beautifully and entirely beyond our control.
That's so lovely. Do you know, quite often on these podcasts, we hear stories about people who have been helped by big names who have sort of got them together, or got them started, or found the music or whatever. And I love that. I love when someone who's so established in their world helps other people and just put you guys together to form something brilliant.
I think it makes a lot of sense to me as well, because I think if you're a big enough star to kind of be able to see the kind of ecosystem of theatre in the world that you work, and you've worked with all the writers, and you know all the writers and the kind of stuff out there, you know, you're in that position to be able to go, actually, I think these people might be quite good at it. You know, it was something that he was like, no, I can see that. I can see you guys working well in this world. And he was very supportive. So Michael was brilliant when we first, you know, gave us a bit of advice, just said, start writing, start coming up with stuff. You need a bit of guidance. And that's where Jonathan Butterwell came in, because mm-hmm. Jonathan's got a lot of experience, particularly working in America, New York, on musicals.
And he's a Sheffield boy, which is why we set the show in Sheffield and opened in Sheffield. So we located it kind of in his sort of childhood haunts, really, which is an area of Sheffield called Parson Cross, where the show is still set as we move into London. And then we just wanted to meet Jonathan to get some advice from a director. We had no idea that he had a secret plan to bring us onto this project. And then pretty much a year after meeting him, we were doing our first workshop, and 3 years on, having had a hugely successful run, to our surprise and delight, in Sheffield, where we literally sold out the entire theatre on word of mouth, because we are an unknown show, brand new writers, no famous songs, no names in the cast, and not really much of a publicity budget. And we didn't sell a lot of tickets until we opened and people saw it at the first dress rehearsal, the public dress rehearsal. And on word of mouth, we sold out the whole theatre, and it just kind of went crazy. And then Nika Burns heard the rumours in London that there was a show that was worth seeing. She went down to see final performance, and in the interval she collared Jonathan and said, I want to take your show to London. So it has been the most fairy tale story of a show, which is kind of about a boy's fairy tale as well. So I think someone could make a musical about our lives in a few years.
Two people who write a musical, and before they know it, they're on the West End.
It becomes quite meta, doesn't it?
That whole kind of let's put on a show right here really has happened to us.
It's in the show, it talks about, I think, Jamie's mother is very central to the She's as much part of it as he is,
absolutely.
I think you find in the documentary, it was the thing that drew us to the story as much as anything else. Once we'd seen it, we could see this central relationship was between, you know, a mum and her son, and this essentially very modern family, this kind of single parent family, and this kid that doesn't quite fit in, and how she supports him, and how she kind of adapts to the situation and thinks, well, I want to support my boy in whatever he wants to do. And just the love between them, which is just that thing, that parental love, which is kind of very touching to watch. And I think with that at the core of our story, we knew our story was always going to be quite universal.
And cross-generational, which is really important to me. I think, if you look at the poster and see the school uniform and the idea of a 16-year-old, you might think it's a kind of like fame or something, it's just the kids. But it has incredibly strong parts for women who often are ignored in the theatre once they get to that age. It has very strong parts for men who are older, and it has a bunch of kids in it as well. And we wrote it absolutely to be for the mums in the audience and for the kids in the audience and the grandparents and everybody in between. And we did have many repeat attendees.
Repeat offenders. Well, yes.
in our 19 shows, we did have one woman who saw it 10 times. And we had grandparents would come and see it and then come back and bring their grandchildren. And that happened a lot. So we really kind of, something that I wanted to do, I mean, I'm thrilled for the success, but I never thought it would have this success. But what I absolutely wanted to do that it did do was to appeal to, well, it's a musical my nan would love to watch. And it had to do that for me, as well as be kind of edgy and cool and poppy and have all the contemporary stuff.
And it's got a pretty strong message, one would think, with the subject matter of a message of acceptance, the message of love. Do you see it as a sort of campaigning show, or do you think the message just comes within the joy of the musical?
The message is there for free. We just wanted to tell a lovely story, and it's actually about identity. And there's something that struck me with the show is that this is a show about a boy who wants to wear a dress. Everyone has a dress they want to wear, whether it's an actual dress like Jamie, or like his best friend in the show, Pretty, who wants to be a doctor, or like me and Dan wanting to write songs and scripts and be in the theatre. Everyone has something they love that they're a little bit scared to own and admit to, and very few people ultimately put their dress on, but Jamie's someone who did. And that should speak to absolutely everyone. But it is about identity, and actually Act Two is surprising. It's not what you think it's going to be. Jamie kind of goes off the rails a bit, and it's much about him finding himself again and working out what he really is, as much as it is about what shoes, what dress, what hair.
And that's what's universal about being 16. That's that point in your life when you know, you're kind of right on the verge, right on the edge of possibility. You know, there's so many different places you can go, so many different things that you can, choices you can make. And what kind of grown-up are you going to be, you know? And that's why identity is quite important at that age, because you're trying to figure out how you fit in, how you're going to fit in, you know, what kind of grown-up are you going to be? And I think it's tough for everyone at that age. It really is. And we knew that the story would have a message just by telling the story. You know, it's not something we didn't feel we've had to bang a drum particularly. You know, the story is there.
It's incredibly topical right now. Yeah. I mean, there are so many stories about gender fluidity, you know.
Well, we'd like to say that we predicted that, but we didn't.
Okay, you were ahead, again, you were ahead of the curve.
It was just luck. I mean, really, it was luck, because, I mean, we saw the story, we loved the story, we started telling the story, and you know what musicals are like, they take years and years to do. Mm. So if we thought that you know, it was going to be part of the zeitgeist, you know, in the 4 years it took to actually get it to the stage, you know, that would have been a mad thing. The truth is, I think we just picked up on what young people were thinking. And what young people who are either LGBT or just young people generally, what they're dealing with is identity more than ever, especially kind of in a kind of selfie culture, in a culture where everyone is branding themselves. You know, young people are, you know, so image conscious, and they're so into kind of turning themselves into a brand and having that thing where they're kind of center of their universe, which is kind of right at that age. But what comes with that is all this stuff about identity, all this stuff about, you know, how am I going to come across? What's my image? What's my look? How do I express myself through my clothes? How do I express myself through my look and all that kind of stuff? And I think it's really, really topical for kids now, more so than ever.
Mm. And also, I would hope that the message, that sort of dare to be different, because I think with so many young people, well, obviously the easy thing is to go with the flow, to be like everybody else.
It's a pressure on them.
And the minute that you want to be different from everybody else, in whatever way that is, but even if you want to be
different, there's this whole thing about you've got to be different, but you've got to get it right. You know what I mean? You've got to get it right. You can't afford to be not cool for a minute, you know.
I'll be different if you will.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm. Are you different? Are you different but cool different? Or are you different but just, you know? You can still get it wrong when you're a kid. It's awful. And I think, you know, what was lovely about telling the story is Jamie is so kind of sure of what he wants. And he was in the documentary. This all comes from what we got from the documentary. Yeah. But he was so sure of himself. And he was so, knew he was different, but he was okay with it. And it kind of represented our new generation of kids who are just really kind of aware that they're different, but owning it and going, no, where am I okay with that?
And also for Margaret, the mum, Margaret Campbell, who's Jeremy Campbell's real mum, who a woman who we admire hugely and now know really rather quite well, and Margaret knew our fictional version. Margaret Campbell is a woman who, if her son wasn't this extraordinary thing who wanted to be a drag queen, living in County Durham where she does, she probably would never have met anyone like him. But there's never a question in any fibre of her being that she's not going to support him, absolutely. And Margaret Campbell has this lovely thing she said to us about, she said, I don't care if you're wearing a plant pot, if you're walking and wearing a plant pot on your head. She said, I mean, I might look at you because you're wearing a plant pot on your head. I might say to you, why are you wearing a plant pot on your head? But I'm not going to judge you or care about it. And I thought that was a really healthy way of looking at it. It's all right to look at different things and go, I do find this maybe a bit challenging, a bit scary and a bit odd, but then be able to say, well, so tell me about it, you know, engage with it. And that's what she did as a parent. And it's so inspirational for all parents, whether you've got a kid who wants to be as radically different as Jamie, or just a kid who is just going to be as different as teenagers are, that she's someone who her love and support is so, it's this solid seam that runs through everything in the show and builds to the big song of the show in Act 2, which is hers.
And when young people came to see it in Sheffield, they also like, okay, I've got to bring my mum to this.
Yeah,
well, many people.
Someone in Sheffield who works at Boots tweeted, oh my God, the kick-ass mum from Jamie's just come in and bought mascara. And so Josie Walker, who plays Margaret, was a kind of hero for all these kids in Sheffield who were saying, oh, you're the mum that I want. And then mums would say to us, oh, Jamie's the son that I want.
But that's the crucial message, as much as the message for kids who want to be different, is a message to parents. If your child is different, love them and support them. Just love them.
Yeah,
that's
them.
All it's about, really, is just loving them.
Yeah, and you can when you see it, you know, when you see it in front of your eyes and when it's kind of put in front of you in a show which is full of fun and drama and tears and laughter and all that kind of stuff, you see it, you kind of leave the theatre feeling kind of like inspired and you leave the theatre feeling like, you know what, the world is actually quite a brilliant place because we've told this one person's story. Mm-hmm. You leave making with that sense that the world is actually not that terrible a place and actually people get through it, you know.
Jamie's, the musical is in a quite small club of mainstream West End shows which don't have a love story at the heart of it, because actually the love story is Jamie and his mum. It is a mother and son love story, and that's what we wanted to write and celebrate.
That's lovely. Now, the show has already won numerous awards from its run in Sheffield. Dan Gillespie-Sells, from The Feeling, you have won the Stage Debut Award for Best Composer.
I know, it's
for
nice.
For your first musical.
Well, it's also nice. The first person to ever win that award as well, aren't you?
Am I? I don't know.
Yeah, it's the first
I find it hilarious but always really touching, because part of me thinks, well, you know, I've been writing songs for 20 years, been my job for such a long time. So to get this kind of debut award, I felt like a bit of a charlatan. I thought, oh no, I mean, I've had loads of practice. but the thing that was lovely about it, though, more than anything, was to feel that I'd been accepted into a new community. I didn't want to swan into the theatre world as being someone who's written pop music. And I didn't want to swan in as if it was going to be something that I could just pick up and do easily without any effort. I knew it was going to be a serious challenge. You know, a bigger challenge than I've ever taken on before.
And did it feel very different writing for a musical than writing for a band?
Yes, because it's the detail, the level of detail. What I wanted to do was, I didn't want to suddenly pull my music out of shape and stop it being catchy. I didn't want to suddenly it become like a different kind of music just because it's in the theatre. I know that what I do well is write pop songs. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to do what I do well. But I also knew that those songs had to work for the piece in a much more detailed way. And in a more precise way than when you're just doing an album, and you can experiment with lots of different, you know, things, and you can be a little bit vague lyrically and all that kind of stuff. You know, with this thing, working with Tom, we managed to create songs that were exactly on point for the show, but didn't lose their integrity as pop songs.
Tom, you hadn't written lyrics before, or
no,
had you?
No, no.
No, so you were dealing with writing lyrics that hopefully move the story along or encompass the story. Was that difficult?
I think difficult is things you struggle at that aren't fun. This was a lot of struggle, but it was so much fun that I would never describe it as difficult. I mean, it was a lot of hard work. We cut probably as many songs as we wrote.
Mm-hmm.
A couple because they weren't great, but most of them actually were great, but we just went, they're not right. So there was a lot of kind of falling in love with something and then having to kind of let it go. And it's a ruthless form because you have sometimes so few syllables to sell a massive idea and try and hit a rhyme and make it singable and scan and have the emphasis on the
right syllable. I didn't make life particularly easily for Tom as a lyricist.
Dan's a rhythm Nazi. I'm a rhyme Nazi.
Okay.
I am so determined that my rhythmical patterns of my vocals would stay intact. Yeah. What I didn't want was, I feel like sometimes a lyric can pull a melody out of shape a little bit in order to make the lyric work. Mm. And if the lyric wins, then I think it might as well have just been said. You've got to make the melody win. And actually, out of that battle, what happens is when you get a lyric that really matches the melody in such a beautiful way, it helps the lyric. It makes it a better lyric. It's that beautiful marriage of words and music.
And I think, might be a line which, without the music, maybe doesn't sound any better, maybe even sounds worse. But you put the music on and it transforms. Like, a lyric isn't a line from a poem. It's not a line from a story. A lyric is only a lyric when it has the music on it.
Yeah.
And it was the hugest learning curve for me to see and to watch the moment where I might provide something to Dan and then he'd sit and sing it and it would just lift off. Or watching something just collapse. And sometimes it's quite hard to pin down why. But we were so strict and ruthless about if it doesn't work, it goes.
But you do hear songs, don't you, where the lyric's crammed in and then the emphasis is on the wrong syllable, as I say.
That's
and
on the wrong syllable.
They
just kind of like come in at a weird place in the sentence. Mm-hmm. Your sentences go up and down naturally. And if you can get your melodies to match that, that's a beautiful thing. And also, you know, a lyric can often be too long, and I think that what happens is sometimes you get this kind of slightly long phrase and then the melody has to be extended to match it, and then it's not tight anymore.
You put some extra notes in.
Some extra notes in, you kind of extend the melody a little bit and you extend your hook. You've got the hook here, but then you make it a little bit longer so that it says all the stuff you want it to say. But the fact is, if you can say it in less words, it's always going to be a better sentence anyway. It's better dialogue if you can say it in less words. Once you distill things down, and if you can say the same thing in less time, you're a winner. Like, that's what rhythm in theatre is all about, I've learned, is being able to pace it out properly, you know, to be able to say, can we just say that in a slightly more tight way? Can we just imply that? Do we have to say everything? Can we show that instead of tell it? And all those kind of tricks of theatre, which I'm learning. I mean, but the learning curve for me has been enormous. For both of us.
Well, 3 years we've been doing it, it's like doing a degree course with some of the most talented, experienced people that you could ever hope to work with. And it's been I mean, sometimes infuriating because you want something to work and it won't, and you end up having to trash it and come at it from a completely different angle. But so many times it just falls into place and you just think, wow, that's amazing. And because my background's film and TV, where you write a screenplay and then if it gets made, it's going to be a long time down the line and you have multiple departments and you shoot and you edit and there's post and there's prep and all these great things. But if you write a song, we could go into Dan's studio with nothing, finish with a song that's complete. I mean, okay, it's just a vocal and piano, a vocal and guitar. It's going to be added to, but it's in many ways it's done, and you go from nothing to this thing. You can come out and walk home and sing it. You know, I've found sometimes I find myself singing one of our songs in the shower, and I realized the other day how many of the words I don't know anymore, and I've forgotten them. But it's such a wonderful discipline, and I'm so glad I finally got to do it because I've always wanted to, and now I have. It's just been wonderful.
I don't think we've ever had such a great analytical discussion on the writing of songs for musicals on our podcast.
This is brilliant.
No, but the trouble is we're completely full of it, right? Yeah. Because we're completely full of it because we're like in that kind of honeymoon phase of musical theatre writers where we're like, oh, we've learned this trick and we've learned that trick. And I'm sure there's lots of people listening to this going, yeah, we've heard it all before. Yeah, we know it.
Get your third show. See
no, right. I haven't heard it on my podcast before.
Well, I love it because, I mean, I'm kind of interested in anything. You know, we're kind of the kind of people that are interested in what goes on everywhere. But when it comes to theatre, that ability to be at this point in your life, 20 years into my career as a songwriter, and still have so much more to learn, still have so much more to take on, you know, I'm kind of thrilled by it. The other thing we have learned, though, you know, as well, that you can make as many rules as you like. You can say, oh, this works because of that, and that works because of that. But at the end of the day, you end up having to break your rules. Mm-hmm. And then you end up also having to just trust instinct. And you end up just having to go, I know that goes against everything I've just been saying for the last year, but I'm going to do it anyway because it feels right.
Which you have done a couple of times. Some of those beautiful moments in the show are where we have broken our rules.
Yeah.
But it's good structure to work to. And I think the kind of discipline, because in the time that we've been doing the show for the last 3 years, Dan's done two albums. I actually moved to Los Angeles in February and just produced 12 hours of TV on American television, and we've done so much stuff in between because we're so disciplined that when we sit down to write, we would get so much done, and then we go, right, we've now got 2 months, we've got to go off and do other things, and then we'd get back together, and we never procrastinated, we were never dilettante about it, and having this kind of structure and this strictness, I think, is what's enabled us to get it all done, and we're always just a little bit ahead of schedule as well, and we've still kept that, we're slightly ahead of where we thought we'd be at this point in rehearsals, and nothing's crashed yet. I mean, I keep waiting for something to go horribly wrong. And
they're in tech rehearsals as
true.
We speak.
Who knows what's happened today while we're here?
So don't.
They're in tech rehearsals for this show, which is previewing on the 6th of November, and then it opens press night 22nd of November.
Yes, so tickets are available from the 6th of November.
Okay. Now,
and they are half price until the 23rd of November, yes.
Until the 23rd. I can't wait to see this. I really can't. This is at the Apollo, Shaftesbury Avenue.
That's right,
it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, Nika Burns Theatre.
Not, not the one where Wicked is, the other Apollo.
Yeah, the other one. I have to ask, Jamie Campbell, who it was originally written about, has he been to see it?
Oh, God, so many times.
Oh, has he?
He was with us.
Has he? He's not creeping out of the limelight.
Well, Margaret, she was Josie Walker, who plays Margaret. And of course, Margaret and Margaret Campbell are, of course, now friends. And Margaret Campbell texted Josie and said, oh, we've got to run through next week, haven't we? And we love that Margaret and Jamie, they say, we've got to run through, which is absolutely right because they are part of our gang. And they have been at the read-through and the run-through and at the press night. They came up and took a bow when we opened in Sheffield. I imagine we'll be doing something fabulous with them when
they'll be there on press night, yeah, absolutely.
They are absolutely part of it. They love the show and we love them.
Yeah, we kept them away from the process. So we brought them in only when it was time to open the show in Sheffield.
We could have our fictional versions, our Jamie knew and our Margaret knew, live in our hearts and minds before we met Margaret Campbell and Jamie Campbell, and then they'd become very real and, you know, we might think, oh, I don't want to write that because maybe it'll upset them. But there's some really hard-hitting stuff in it as well. And there's a song that we wrote, it was one of the last ones we wrote for the show, which is Margaret looking back on her kind of broken heart, so the failed romance over her life. She's not a self-pitching character at all, but this is a moment of introspection. And I hadn't met Margaret Campbell when I wrote the lyric. It was something that I came up with going on a run around Chiswick, which is where I normally write lyrics, running up and down the Thames. And
I'll see you there with my dog.
Oh, I probably have. I was the one running along singing show tunes. And it's Margaret looking back on her life. And I just made it up. You think, if this person was real, I think she would say this. And then Margaret, when we met her, said, it's like you've written my life. It's so close to what happened. And when we did the run-through a couple of weeks ago, it was the first read-through, Margaret was there. And when Josie got up to sing this song, Margaret just looked away and couldn't make eye contact with her. And I realised it was just so powerful for her and so painful in a way. And then as it got to the final bit of the song where it just slows down, these just these little lyrics kind of dipped in, and Margaret just started singing along to them just silently. And I watched, and I thought, oh God, you've been listening to our song. That's your song that we wrote. And it's now part of your real life as well. So they've been woven into the fabric of the show.
Well, it sounds to me, it's on the website, it says fairy tales really do come true. And as you've explained, this is a fairy tale coming true. Let's hope it's a fairy tale night on the 22nd on press night. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And talking to us and analysing songwriting in the most amazing way. And lots of luck with the run. I can't wait to see it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
That was the Musicals and Theatre podcast, and if you enjoyed that, then why not subscribe? It's absolutely free to our channel on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also hear me every weekend morning from 6 till 10 on Mellow Magic.
Are you looking for a Columbus car dealership built on tradition and trust? Buyers Auto, family-owned since 1897, offers top new and pre-owned vehicles. Visit us or shop online at buyersauto.com. Buyers Auto, driving the next generation of buyers.